Hi everyone, it's Dr. Goyal here from PQM Labs, and today I have a very special friend of mine who's also the Varun Dwarka, who's the head of bioinformatics at True Diagnostic. And I think it's going to be a great conversation all about the testing for biologic age, and True Diagnostic is really at the forefront of this whole technology. So let me just tell you a little bit more about Varun. He's, like I said, the head of bioinformatics at True Diagnostic and an aging and longevity investigator specializing in epigenetics and bioinformatics. He has co-authored numerous publications related to genetics, epigenetics, clocks, DNA methylation, and tissue regeneration. In 2020, Dr. Dwarka was elected as a full member to Sigma, how would you pronounce that, Varun?
It's Sigma Chi.
Sigma Chi. The Scientific Research Honor Society, and currently serves as the 2023 Foresight Fellow in Biotechnology and Health Expansion, awarded by the Foresight Institute. He also serves on the Scientific Advisory Board for SRW Labs in New Zealand, offering insight into the application and interpretation of epigenetic age markers. Dr. Dwarka is passionate about implementing machine learning methods to advance predictive medicine, identify novel biomarkers, and create algorithms to better understand biology, the biology of aging. So thank you so much, Varun. I've been waiting for this for a little bit of time, and I know this, you've been super busy, and we're going to get to the new clock that True Diagnostics just come out with. But for our audience, I have done a previous episode on testing for biology age, but obviously we're going to go in more detail today, and we're going to just hear it straight from the expert today from you. But I'd like to kind of give a little bit of background to people, again, about this whole idea about epigenetic clocks and, how did we get there? You know, what's the kind of history about these clocks, and how is that, what's the science behind it? If you could maybe just take us through a little bit of that.
Sure. First of all, thank you for allowing me to speak about this. We're really passionate here at True Diagnostic about the epigenetics and how it relates to aging. And I think that, thank you, really, from all of us here. In terms of the history of it, I mean, we've already known for a while, I think since mid-1900s, that epigenetics and aging are very hand-in-hand. Mm-hmm. Typically, as we age, we're actually accumulating a lot of these epigenetic marks. And mm-hmm. before we go deeper into the specifics of aging, mm-hmm. we have to establish that when we talk about epigenetics, mm-hmm. there are multiple facets of epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And the one that we'll be focusing on the most here is that DNA methylation.
Right.
So it's the addition of methyl groups onto the DNA. And so I just wanted to make sure, because there's also chromatin modifications and non-coding RNAs. So I just wanted to make sure we focus on that.
And so there's interrupting you there. So there's many type of epigenetic modifications which are happening, which you mentioned. There's a lot of science behind the methylation piece, but obviously acetylation happens, sulfonylation probably. I mean, various other things that are happening. So why did they choose methylation in the first place? Like, why is this such a good, marker for looking at aging, for example?
Yeah. It's because we know that DNA methylation accumulates as individuals age throughout the entire aging process. Mm-hmm. And actually, even as early as when development is occurring, especially in the fetal stage, mm-hmm. A lot of the fetus development or even just the cellular development that leads to the fetus being born, developed, and then ultimately that fetus being born as a young baby. Mm-hmm. There's hyper methylation and hyper demethylation occurring during that entire time.
Mm-hmm. And so what does these marks doing specifically? Like, why are these methyl groups coming off and on these various genes?
Well, the popular thought, and the reason why I'll say popular thought, I'll explain, sure. is that what they're actually doing is that they're being added to the DNA itself, and what that's allowing is the modulation of the gene expression that's mm-hmm. occurring. Mm-hmm. So while they're being added onto the actual DNA, mm-hmm. what that actually allows is the repression or the interference of, let's say, certain RNA polymerase or DNA polymerase to be actually able to bind to that that site. Mm-hmm. And then, as we understand from central dogma, DNA undergoes transcription to create RNA, and then RNA undergoes translation to create proteins. Mm-hmm. What you're essentially doing by adding a DNA methylation mm-hmm. marker is that you're inhibiting the ability of RNA polymerase to actually come in, bind to, let's say, a promoter region, mm-hmm. if that promoter region is highly methylated, and mm-hmm. therefore that mRNA or RNA is not being able to be made, which then causes proteins to not be made, and then that whatever biological process that is mm-hmm. at the end of the road, that doesn't actually occur.
So these are, it looks like it's strictly a inhibition or repression of the RNA polymerase. It's not an increase. Doesn't happen like that, or does it?
So that's the thing, is that more recently, because of this whole, the fervor of whole genome bisulfite sequencing and next generation sequencing, what we've actually been seeing is that in certain cases, you actually can have increases of gene expression. But generally speaking, we are seeing that it's typically a repression of that gene expression.
Okay.
It's always a case control basis.
Right.
But it doesn't preclude the fact that there are certain genes that actually will increase their gene expression based on the DNA methylation that's there. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, actually a while back, especially during my PhD dissertation, we actually looked into certain papers that showed that gene body methylation, especially in the introns mm-hmm. Of the gene,
mm-hmm.
Exons of the gene,
mm-hmm.
Actually can allow for increased expression. So
All
based on the really where the location of that DNA methylation is present.
So the DNA methylation happens at a very particular place on the DNA always, right? The CPG site, or it can happen in multiple places, but you're only measuring the CPG sites?
Generally speaking, it happens on any kind of cytosine,
okay.
But because especially in vertebrates,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that methylation occurs in CPGs. So I think it's like 98% of CPGs are actually facilitating a lot of those methylation marks. But you also have CHGs, which is mm-hmm. essentially a cytosine followed by any other type of DNA, and mm-hmm. then a guanine, mm-hmm. a G,
right.
or just lone cytosines themselves. But those are like, 0.2 to 1% are typically methylated there.
Okay. And do we know all of the, do we know the total number of methylation sites on the human genome?
Theoretically, it's about 28 million cytosines.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's theoretically is because, as we start to continue to assemble the human genome,
mm-hmm.
we'll start to, improve our understanding of where these cytosines are.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that too, with next generation sequencing, as whole genome bisulfite sequencing,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially a one-stop shop of being able to sequence all methylated cytosine locations,
mm-hmm.
As that improves, then we'll have a better understanding. But typically, or what we think is that 20 out of the 28 million cytosines, presumably 98% or majority of them can be methylated.
So the amount of information is just incredible there. So basically what's happening is that, from my understanding, is that these patterns of methylation are changing as we in effect get older, and that's a marker for biologic age. Is that correct?
And actually, and I think the paper that really started to show it was Brockland et al. 2011.
Okay.
And there's one co-author from that paper, Stephen Horvath, which I really need to emphasize,
mm-hmm.
because the reason why I really look at these papers is because they started to show that this chronological age mm-hmm. actually was able to, six CPG sites were able to explain age by about 70 to 80%.
So did you say six?
Six CPG.
That's
sites.
It. Just six.
Yeah. And it was just those six, especially in that 2011 paper. But then
right.
in 2013,
right.
what Stephen Horvath was able to do is utilizing
right.
a lot of these methylation array data.
Mm-hmm.
What he was able to do is build a predictor just looking at the DNA methylations, CPG orientations,
mm-hmm.
like the methylation values,
mm-hmm.
and was able to develop a predictor using regression modeling.
Mm-hmm.
And the error rate that you actually saw within that was about 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allowed is that now you can just take any type of sample, like a whole blood tissue or even individual tissue types, and predict the chronological age of that sample without actually knowing what the value was.
Right.
But it is. Yeah.
Yeah. No. That's that. I totally get that. So yeah, Dr. Horvath is considered, in effect, the father of epigenetic clocks. In effect, correct?
Like in effect, yes.
Yes. And the Horvath clock is considered the first generation clock. And so what was the problem? Like some of these clocks, yeah, were very good at predicting chronologic age. What was the problem that people were noticing, and what was the, you know, why have we gone forward beyond that?
I don't necessarily know if it was a problem or not, but I mean, it's the whole basis of curiosity, right? Like, you know, once you do something, you're like, hey, can we tweak it? Like, how would it work this way? Mm-hmm. One of the things that Horvath noticed is that there was almost a limit in how close we can get to predicting, you know, chronological age, because as a forensic, you know, you would want to get that error rate to zero.
Right.
If you have a blood sample, you can just get it to, hey, this is the age and that's it.
Yeah.
For some reason, you were always hitting a theoretical limit on the error of how much you can actually explain.
And that has to be the natural variation in our variation in biology, in effect, of biologic age.
Exactly. And so that's why the whole concept of biological age started to occur. And then people started to think, okay, well, you know, we really want to step away from this whole idea of chronological age, because, you know, you could just ask a person how old they are, and then they typically will know their date of birth. Mm-hmm. But what happens when we start to implement things that, like, for example, phenotypic scores that are based on different protein levels that we already in the clinic use, as you're very well aware of. Can we build scores on that and then train the methylation to those scores to predict those type of values? And what essentially that started to create were these biological clocks where you could incorporate chronological age because it is still an important factor, but you're using that as an adjustment rather than the thing that you're trying to predict. And ultimately, when people started to do that, what you're starting to see is that these values or these predicted values that come from these machine learning models or these algorithms, they actually started to show significant associations to disease prediction. So predicting risk of disease or all-cause mortality, which in the clinic, what we hear at True Diagnostic and also from our own discussions, that's more useful than just, you know, something like chronological age.
Yeah.
And, so not saying that the first generations were not important. It's just more now we're improving the predictability or the risk prediction using these biological outputs rather than the chronological age itself.
Yeah, so basically these new clocks, and we're going to start talking about some of them, you know, we're able to predict disease and in effect are more clinically useful. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Clocks like Grimage, and I'd love to talk about Dunedin, the PACE clock as well, and what makes that different. But and then finally, I'd like to talk about the latest clock that True Diagnostics is coming out with. But maybe just take me through a little bit about the Dunedin PACE clock. Like, what made that clock different, and probably was, up until most now, the most accurate clock out there for biologic age.
Absolutely. And actually, I do have a few slides just as
Let's
kind of
that.
A concept.
That's
Is it
awesome.
Okay if I pull that up?
Absolutely. That'd be a big help.
Yeah. So I figured that a lot of the slides that I have here, I kind of explain that in more of a visual. I'm more of a visual guy, so it really does help me. So I understand that this schematic is a little bit tough to follow, but ultimately what you're seeing are these first generation clocks on the left, and each of these little boxes represent the different clocks, and then the second generation clocks on the right. But when we start to look into, for example, the Dunedin PACE, what was really important about Dunedin PACE is that rather than focusing on a heterogeneous population of, let's say, like 5,000 or 6,000 individuals. From a machine learning perspective, that can add a lot of, it captures a lot of variance, population variance, which is good because now you're able to predict from a larger pool. It also adds a lot of error in terms of the predicting aspect. But what Dunedin PACE was able to do is, using a large sample size of about 1,000 and I think 37 individuals, they actually started to incorporate longitudinal information. So following those individuals from the time of birth all the way to the age of 45.
Yeah, so basically they had watched people's birth from birth, I think in 1972 or something. They followed
It was 1972.
They followed a cohort of people they've been following it for the last 50 years in effect.
In effect the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing during that time was that they were actually collecting a lot of clinical values that that were very important in developing this pace of aging score.
Got it.
And so what I mean by that is they had cardiovascular, metabolic, your renal, your hepatic, all of these different clinical covariates that are associated with these different systems. Mm-hmm. And then using that, they generated a pace of aging score. Mm-hmm. Now, the score is different than, for example, let's say phenoage. A phenoage is essentially an epigenetic age, but it kind of resembles your chronological age. Like, for example, if you're 45 years old, it might give you a number that's 47. So it's kind of in the same units scale.
Yes, right. In age units, in effect.
In age units.
Right.
Here, they actually were thinking about it from, hey, age units are great, but why not convert it into more of a speedometer, where one means that you're actually aging at the same exact, that you're 45 and you're 45 and you're eight. So every year you're aging, you're increasing by 1 year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then it also goes up. So anything higher than one, and based on the Dunedin cohort, they bounded it by 1 to 1.4. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain why I say bounded, but 1 to 1.4,
mm-hmm.
what that means is for every year, if let's say you have a pace score of 1.1, mm-hmm. for every year that that passes, you actually increase your age by 1.1, so about 10%.
Got it.
Versus 0.9, for every year you increase, you actually increase by 0.9, so a 10% decrease. In and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that type of speedometer, what they started to see is that pace of aging score actually showed significant improvements in associating with different disease comorbidities and also mortality on top of that. And then using that score, that, you know, 1.1, 0.9, that spectrum, they were able to train it to DNA methylation data and then create a predictor that way just from the DNA methylation itself.
Hmm. And so do we have a sense of when, let's say, I've seen this from my patients, number of these scores, how long do we think that score is valid for? Like, is that score valid for, like, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year? Like, how fast has the pace of aging score changed? Do we have any sense from the data?
Yeah, that's a great question. So typically at True Diagnostic, we recommend individuals to take it every 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually have some data that we'll be publishing soon from diet types.
Mm-hmm.
And this was interesting because the Dunedin pace actually changed within 8 weeks.
Okay, so it is modifiable.
To kind of explain that that study just a little bit,
sure.
Is that we followed twins, a set of, I think, 21 twins.
Wow.
And and one set of twins were subjected with a omnivore diet versus a vegan diet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And following those twins for about 8 weeks,
mm-hmm.
it was interesting to see that Dunedin pace was one of the few clocks, if not the only clock, mm-hmm. that actually showed a significant decrease in the vegan diet relative to the omnivore diet.
Wow.
However, this is unpublished data, and we are working on, you know, making sure that all of these outputs are correct. But based on the initial analyses, it seems like it's looking like that. And
what
is interesting about it is that 8 weeks was enough to really reduce it.
So does it mean then that with that lower score, that their risk, I mean, theoretically, their risk for all various other outcomes would have improved? Is that not correct?
That's the assumption, obviously.
Yeah.
And obviously, we'll have to do additional, follow-ups based on their, you know, CRP levels and maybe
right.
some of their other blood levels. But because of these strong, significant associations to disease risk, we can say that the reduction of that Dunedin pace, what we would expect is that their overall disease risk and overall all-cause mortality would have decreased as well, the risk of death. In the next, let's say, 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no, that makes total sense. Just before we move on further, this is all done in whole blood testing. Is that correct? glucosides?
Typically, so for example, Dunedin, Pace, and Grimage were really trained on a lot of whole blood samples, and therefore, you know, you want to be able to use the algorithms based on the type of samples that they were created. Mm-hmm. Some of the things, like for example, the Horvath Generation 1 clock, that was really interesting because it used a heterogeneous population of tissues. So technically, you could actually use, I think muscle tissue was one of them. So you could actually, if you have muscle tissue, you can actually use the Horvath clock on that sample type. And we also have muscle clocks too, which were trained specifically for muscle tissue as well. So,
how much variation is there, like between tissues in the methylation patterns? Like, how much are we talking about? Like a couple of percent?
A lot. There's a huge school of thought that methylation might be the marker for differentiation. So, based on the orientation of DNA methylation, that could actually allow cell to go through differentiation types from like a stem cell to specific cell lineages.
Okay, so it's not okay. They're all using epigenetic methylation. We can all do that for all tissues, but you're saying it's not very. You can't just swap a tissue for another. Is what you're saying? They're quite different.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, especially when you're vetting a lot of these clocks, being mindful of like how these clocks, what was the starting, you know, tissue type? What was the tissue type that it was trained on? Because a whole blood, for example, Dunedin paste may not work as well on, let's say, a fibroblast specific population.
Right.
Because we've done that before, is utilizing Dunedin paste on just fibroblast cell data. And we see some wonky numbers. And that just comes from the fact that fibroblasts will have very different methylation states relative to whole blood and even the immune cells that compose whole blood.
And why? How did True Diagnostic or any of these other clocks decide on which of the 28 million CPGs they would look at? Like, how was that determined?
It's all part of the training process, really. So the methodology that's very popular is this machine learning methodology called penalized regression modeling. And what it essentially does is that it fits essentially a linear regression, but then it accounts for squeezing the error of a lot of these CPG sites. And and ultimately, I think when it comes down to it, you're selecting CPGs or these methylation sites that really are predictive of the outcome that you're looking for. So let's say in the case of Dunedin Pace, if the outcome was that Pace score, you wanted to really select what that penalized regression model method does is that it selects the CPG sites and the overall methylation values that really predict that pace of aging score to the lowest error rate. And so it's through that saying that, hey, these CPGs are very somewhat important for that overall pace of aging.
Okay, so it's not like we're missing anything. These are by far the best CPGs that reflect for these clocks. And is there a lot of commonality between the CPGs used in these clocks?
There's a beautiful paper. I'm actually going to switch over to another presentation because I think there was a beautiful paper by Morgan Levine's group. Let me just make sure that it's up here.
No problem.
Yes.
Oh, there. Good. Awesome.
This preprint came out, and I believe it's still a preprint. If it's been published, I'll look it up. But it is by Morgan Levine's group where they actually compared all of these different CPGs from each of these clocks. So on your x-axis right here, what you'll see is the different types of clocks. So when they say pan tissue, that's actually the Horvath clock. Remember I mentioned that it was built on multiple tissue types?
Yeah.
That's what the whole pan tissue represents. The PhenoAge, the Hanum clock, Grimage, Dunedin Pace. There's also an estimation of telomere length that's based on DNA methylation, and so on and so forth. But what is interesting here is that on your y-axis, it's the percent of similarity of CPGs, essentially. And each of these color-coded boxes that are within the bar graph, the bar graph, represent the CPGs that are shared between CPGs that belong to a certain biological process. And so what you'll notice is that as you go across the x-axis between the clocks, those sub-bars change based on their overall length. Mm-hmm. And it varies based on clock to clock. So for example, the Grim Age and Dunedin Pace, mm-hmm. or here it's called Dunedin Poem, you know, they have similar color codes, but the value of, let's say, the reds are a lot greater in the Grim Age versus the Dunedin Pace.
Got it.
And so what this is suggesting is that each clock is picking out different CPGs yeah. because of the way that they were being trained. Yeah. And so while there is commonality, there's actually a lot more differences between clocks as well. Mm-hmm. So for example, this Zane clock, this is a first generation clock. It has nothing similar with another first generation clock like the Horvath mm-hmm. Clock, and it's capturing something completely different. Mm-hmm. And what is interesting is that this was still trained by chronological age, but mm-hmm. they used a different type of selection model. Mm-hmm. It's called a BLUP and BLUP model, and then also an elastic net type model system. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that just even the change of the model type can actually influence what type of CPGs you're picking out.
So this is a bit of a dumb question, but why is there two columns for each clock?
That's actually a very good question. That's actually a good question. I will look into the paper okay. to find out.
Okay,
cool. I know that they did, I think, duplicates, or there's...
Yeah, maybe it's two.
There's some type of replication that was occurring, but I'll look into it. But
okay.
overall, they should be representing the same clock overall.
And before we move on to the ohmic clock, I'd love to just... what about between animals, like human versus, you know, other animals or rats or dogs and stuff? What is that? How similar are the CPGs for aging?
There was a paper by Horvath, so Aki Liu and Horvath, that recently came out. I skimmed through it, but they did suggest that there was actually a set of CPGs that are conserved mm-hmm. across all, I think, mammals. And mm-hmm. so they actually have created a mammalian clock mm-hmm. that's able to look at aging across, and that same clock could be used not only in humans, but in mm-hmm. rats, dogs, and also, I think, any type of mammal that's out there. Mm-hmm. And what it showed is that there's actually a conservation of this aging phenotype across the across DNA methylation. Mm-hmm. But however, obviously, you know, you're comparing, let's say, a human to a mouse to a dog, mm-hmm. the DNA methylation is going to skew widely. Mm-hmm. But the way that they were able to train it is that they were still able to identify a set of CPGs that are consistent across the mammalian phenotype. And mm-hmm. they actually have created a clock mm-hmm. Based on that too. Mm-hmm. And one of the really cool things about that is now you have a standardized way of measuring age that is intra-species or mm-hmm. inter-species,
right.
My apologies.
Right, right. It takes into account the various lifespans because the lifespans are so different from the different animals as well.
Exactly. Right, so like a naked mole rat apparently has significantly longer lifespan than, I was a naked mole rat, but
yeah.
their lifespan is significantly longer than other
rodents.
Rodents, if
yeah.
you will.
Yeah, yes. Okay, take me through why did, you know, you guys go down a True Diagnostic down the road to developing the ohmic clock. So maybe let's talk about that.
Sure, yeah. And I think the inspiration really came from, you know, mm-hmm. you know, at True Diagnostic, we use a lot of these clocks. I mean, we exclusively license mm-hmm. Dunedin Pace. Mm-hmm. We're big fans of Grim Age, but we mostly use Dunedin Pace. Mm-hmm. But we started to realize that there's actually, you know, in the advent of next generation sequencing, mm-hmm. the way that a lot of these clocks, especially with Grim Age, mm-hmm. were generated is that they're cherry picking specific phenotypes mm-hmm. and clinical values that we already know, mm-hmm. preconceived notions. Mm-hmm. But especially with elastic net regression, what that allows is a data driven approach to pick out what is important or related to this overall phenotypic that's really associated to aging itself. And so what we decided to do was we partnered with Harvard University, specifically Brigham's Women's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we partnered with them is that they have a biobank of mm-hmm. more than 60,000 individuals mm-hmm. where they had all of these different clinical covariates.
Right. So they had all the clinical data, plus they had the epigenetic data. Is that right?
So they actually had a lot of these clinical covariates.
Right.
And then the blood that associated with those clinical covariates, mm-hmm. Of those individuals.
Right.
And so what we were able to do is utilizing this biobank, mm-hmm. we collected all that blood and we actually ran the proteomics, the metabolomics, and the methylation itself. And then they already had the EMR data from the clinics. Mm-hmm. And so we actually incorporated all that. Mm-hmm. And so on the left side, this is the idea, was that we took all of these different layers mm-hmm. and tried to combine them in order to produce a multi-omic inferred type of clock mm-hmm. that is, again, trained on methylation. So first we wanted to do this kind of following a very similar step of
So first you go ahead and you actually go and measure all of those aspects, find the relationship between them, and then you train it to the methylation data. Is that what happens?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and I think that this kind of shows a little bit of that schematic. And so the first thing that we had to do was we actually had to create a phenotypic score.
Right.
So kind of like pheno age or even grim age, mm-hmm. where I think earlier on I mentioned that instead of training to chronological age, you can train to a phenotypic score. Mm-hmm. We wanted to generate that first. And so what we did was we actually incorporated this thing called EMR age, where we extracted 61 clinical phenotypes that, you know, through literature searching across 60,000 samples. And what we did was we actually trained that using ElasticNet regression to identify a set of clinical phenotypes that really explained, that was trained to time till death. Because ultimately, we wanted to create something that was clinically relevant and was able to predict when mortality would actually hit.
So you had all of these values, you had 61 clinical phenotypes of these people, and because you had their actual time of death, you were able to train time to death and the relationship here. So you basically created an EMR age, is that right? Based on
the
61.
And we created, yes. And this is very similar to what was done with Grim Age, where Grim Age, they did something similar, except they only used, I think, about 11 or so metrics or of these, I think it was clinical metrics. We increased that by 61, and this was, again, because we were working with the biobank.
Got it.
And mm-hmm. ultimately, what we've actually identified were things that previously were never considered because, you know, we had a larger pool, and we allowed a data-driven approach mm-hmm. to pick these things out. So, like, Charlson scores, which is essentially the within 10 years, is that individual going to survive or not? It's widely used amongst clinical practitioners. Mm-hmm. So Charlson scores, smoking, AST, I think it's glucose.
These were all risk factors. These were all associated with increasing EMR age. Is that correct?
These are all the guts of that EMR age that really were able to predict that time till death.
And just so our viewers can see that here, you know, things like glucose, obviously triglycerides type of, you know, lipid, creatinine, which is a sign of kidney function, and obviously age. So the increased age you are, the increased EMR age you would be. I mean, strong positive correlation.
But notice that we're not using this as the training, the final training feature, but we're using it as a component, which still has some impact.
Right, and then you have here the protective aspects were albumin. The greater the albumin was protective, being female is protective. BMI, lower the BMI. Lower diastolic pressure. Is that correct?
These are all protected. And the direction would represent higher EMR age.
Got it. Okay, perfect. Yeah, so let's move on. So then?
And so from that, so we generated EMR age. And mm-hmm. so I think that one thing I want to kind of move towards is mm-hmm. then now how did we incorporate a lot of these values? Mm-hmm. And so first thing after developing EMR age, that's mm-hmm. our final training product. So we're training everything to that.
Right.
Now, what we're starting to do is, from this, we collected all the methylation data of individuals that had EMR, all the EMR information. But then we also had to figure out a way to integrate the proteins, mm-hmm. the clinical values, and the metabolites. Now, this was actually kind of a tedious process because, again, all of these different values are not the same as methylation, and their distribution from a statistical standpoint is completely different than just methylation itself.
Got it.
So one a way that we tried to do it was actually by predicting all of these proteins, the clinical values and metabolites using methylation. So now we're creating additional models from the methylation to predict the protein values, the clinical values, and the metabolite values. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I really want to stress is that there are a lot of these. So meaning, because there's 2,098 different protein groups that we identified from this data, we would have to create 2,098 different models for each of those proteins.
Got it.
Same thing with the clinical, and same thing with the metabolites.
Right.
So one way we reduced it was we wanted to, again, since we're training it to EMR age, here it says bio age, but it's a nomenclature difference.
Got it.
We essentially filtered this to only identify those proteins, metabolites, and clinical values that had a correlation to bio age, and which retained about 107 proteins, 21 clinical, and 267. And then we created models for these 396.
So these were the things that are the most, have the most influence on bioage. These 107 protein, 21 clinical, and 267 metabolates. These were like the most important.
These would be the ones that were highly related to that bioage.
And so just so people understand, I mean, what is a 0.1 correlation? How would you explain that in a lay?
It's essentially a correlation would just be as a value. If you were to plot these values on a just on like a x and y axis, if one of those values increase, the other one would have to increase as well. Mm-hmm. And so the 0.1 is a loose correlation, but it's essentially a way to just filter so that you're actually identifying things that, as let's say, for example, if aspartate, the regular aspartate measure, if that increases, the predicted value from that methylation would also increase at the same magnitude in the same direction.
Okay, so let's just say a value of aspartame was 1. How close would the predicted value have to be to 1 or in the same direction?
We would hopefully expect them to be within, let's say, 0.5.
0.5.
So if it was 1 in the clinical value, the predicted value from the methylation would at least have to be somewhere close to 0.5.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
But one of the things is even if the scales are a little bit off, the difference, let's say if you took aspartate twice and it went from 1 to 2, even if the scale was off, that difference would hopefully be 2 to 3on the predicted side as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But one of the things now is that we're adding granularity here too. Mm-hmm. And so when we identify these 21 clinical and then all these different proteins and metabolites, we also check their correlations. And what was surprising here is that now we have methylation predictions for each of these different clinical values altogether. So FEV1, smoking, FVC, and so on and so forth. And so finally, I'm going through this a little quick, and the reason why we created all these is because we added them into the creation of this EMRH. And so through that actually added additional clinical relevance, because now we're including all of these different aspects into this EMRH prediction, if you will. Then also the immune cell convolution. So just really quickly, I wanted to say that we published this paper where we're now, from methylation data, we can actually predict the levels or relative percentages of different immune cell subtypes, which is really important, because since we're using whole blood tissue, whole blood is composed of multiple different immune cells, and those fluctuations actually have been shown to affect epigenetic clock outcomes. So if you have, let's say, a significant increase in this one cell type that's not because of aging, that could skew the overall estimation. So by including that, what we were doing is trying to control for those fluctuations based on those single immune cells.
So I know we have just a couple of minutes. I just want to make sure I get this for the viewers. So basically, there's a new clock, which is the omic clock. Is that correct? Which now incorporates this data onto the methylation. Is that correct?
Yes,
and all these and the proteins and clinical metrics and metabolites, and now you can go back and actually predict the levels of these proteins and clinical markers as well. Now you can go backwards by just doing.
Yeah, and actually that's where a lot of the magic is happening. Is that mm-hmm. sometimes now we now add granularity, so mm-hmm. We can see the overall omic age, mm-hmm. but then if you see an increase and you're wondering why, then you can start to look into mm-hmm. the levels of those proteins, the clinical values, and the mm-hmm. metabolites mm-hmm. that, and see if those things are actually changing mm-hmm. Or those are increasing and how mm-hmm. that relates to your omic age. So mm-hmm. now you can start to focus on treatments to regulate those specific aspects.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Is there a slide that kind of explains the omic age? Like, I mean, just kind of so just the viewers can kind of get a sense of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think by the end of it, ultimately, this is kind of showing how omic age, what's in it. But then I think the biggest thing really is the association to diseases.
Yes,
and how we compare that to other clocks. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing here are these measures called odds ratios. So every if you're at one, that means there's a one-to-one association between that. It's essentially, you could think of it as almost like 0% risk,
right.
essentially.
Got it.
What you want to be is right in the middle mm-hmm. Or even lower. So mm-hmm. what you're seeing here, though, is omic MH is colored as this dark purple almost.
Right.
And then your PC Grimage and all of these other clocks are kind of on the left side with a lighter shade of mm-hmm. blue/green. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is that the sensitivity and the odds ratio of, let's say, predicting type 2 diabetes, cancer, depression, and cardiovascular disease, it's significantly higher in this omic age relative to all of the current clocks that are out there, or a subset of these current clocks.
Yeah, so these are basically the higher the odds ratio, the better the predictive value of the clock for that disease or condition.
Exactly,
because in effect it's able to predict something. Whereas if it was one, it would basically not be predicting anything.
It wouldn't be predicting anything at all, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the last bit is mm-hmm. this 5-year survival prediction. And so, for example, what this is showing is that the false positive, so is it able to predict that individual mm-hmm. is either surviving or deceased within the 5 years? Mm-hmm. And what you really want to see in this type of a graph is mm-hmm. that the curve of that graph should be closer to the top left quadrant of this plot, essentially. Mm-hmm. And what we see here again is that the purple, the orange, which is omic age,
is
more closer to that quadrant relative to even grim age, which has been really the standard that people have been trying to beat for a while.
So it's the highest sensitivity and specificity clock out there at this time.
Yes, exactly. And so what we're hoping is that, so now we've built it, and so what we're going to start doing is mm-hmm. testing it on different interventions mm-hmm. to say, hey, mm-hmm. as, for example, if let's say you start to incorporate a more fat-based diet, how does that influence your omic age? Are you seeing increases or decreases mm-hmm. or no change? Mm-hmm. How does hyperbaric treatment affect your omic age? And so mm-hmm. that's another way that we started to test. And so that's what mm-hmm. we're going to be doing in the future, to see that association to certain interventions.
Okay, no, this is perfect. I know we're just about to end right now. If you want to just close the sharing, and then we'll just close it off there so we can, everyone can see you. So thank you so much, Varun. This is really good. We'll probably have to do a round two later on once we get more understanding of the omic clock. And for our viewers out there, how can they learn more about this test or get the test done for themselves? Where could they go?
Absolutely. www.trudiagnostic, so TRU mm-hmm. diagnostic. .com. So that's our main website.
Yeah.
We'll have a lot of content there to kind of explain the guts and the intricacies of omic age. Mm-hmm. You can connect with me personally on LinkedIn or Perfect. Instagram. So my Instagram, Varun, Varun Dwarka, Dwaraka. Mm-hmm. And then the same name on LinkedIn.
I'll actually put that in the notes as well for everyone.
Absolutely. And one of the things too is I want to give a shout out to Hannah Wendt. who runs everything epigenetics, because I think that she does a very good job of being able to bridge the science to the clinic and also to the usability in a very approachable way. And so everything epigenetics, it's everywhere, pretty much Instagram, I think Apple Podcasts and all that too. So
I'll add the links for that too. Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah, she's got great guests. I'll add that as well. And for our viewers out there who are in Canada and want to get this testing done, you can go to peakhuman.ca. We'll have the longevity package where you can order those testing. I think we're good. I think we're good to go. I know you got to run, but I really appreciate this time.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Okay. Catch you later.
All right. Bye.